I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis.
And this is Cool Solutions, a show about people protecting our climate from the bottom up.
Each month, we'll introduce you to a powerful climate solution and take you to where it's happening. Our webpage will have information you can use to bring this solution home to your family and community. Let's get cool.
Some forward-thinking communities are choosing grid-scale batteries over power plants as a way to make their electricity cleaner, greener, and leaner.
Today we'll hear the stories of three communities who are taking that path and learn from energy experts how these solar plus battery systems reward their users with lower bills and more reliable power.
Before we begin, I want to talk for a minute about why we do this show. We're sharing stories about communities taking climate action because most greenhouse gas emissions don't come pouring out of chimneys at the White House. Climate pollution is local, and that means we have the power to do something about it. Local governments want climate solutions. A recent survey showed that 70% of U.S. mayors support their city taking climate action, even if it costs them to do it. And most of the time, we get more in return than just jewels in our heavenly crown. And that's why we talk about health, justice, and resiliency, and other benefits of climate action. But the main message of this show is we can't wait for Washington. And there's lots of cool solutions we can do right now, right here where we live. When you think of Southern California beach towns, places like Malibu come to mind. Surfers, movie stars, idyllic beaches. But follow the coastline north 30 miles and you're in another world. Oxnard, a predominantly Hispanic working class community and traditional toxic sacrifice zone. The town has three fossil fuel-fired power plants, two active oil fields, pesticide drift from surrounding fields, a shipping port spewing diesel exhaust, and a Superfund site on top of a landfill with over 450,000 cubic tons of toxic and radioactive waste. The town ranks in the top 6% in the state for pollution exposure and in the top 4% for asthma.
Carmen Ramirez is an Oxnard City Councilwoman and Mayor Pro Tem. She represents the city on the Regional Air Quality Board.
We have a combination of a lot of things that make people sick, and children sick, and elderly people sick. Getting away from fossil fuel is essential for the health of our children, our community.
Residents rejoiced when the state decided to decommission two of Oxnard's aging natural gas power plants, until they learned that another gas-fired plant would be built in its place. The new plant was to be a peaker plant, one that only operates during hours of high electricity demand.
Since emission of pollutants is highest during startup and shutdown, peakers, which frequently turn off and on, are the dirtiest kind of gas plant. They emit nearly four times more pollution per megawatt hour than other gas plants, and they do it at the time of day when air quality is at its worst.
And of course, who is going to pay the price? Our community, poor Spanish-speaking people, working people. And we just said no.
But even though the Oxnard folks had good reason, they weren't just crying NIMBY.
The proposed plant was called Puente, which means bridge in Spanish. Oxnard residents were not opposed to bridging the energy gap created by the closure of the power plants. The community was calling for a paradigm shift from dirty, centralized power to clean, locally generated electricity. They wanted a bridge to a clean energy future.
The state leadership from the governor on down says California's going to be a leader in stopping climate change and in clean energy, and we've seen a lot of progress in the last few years. But a lot of times that progress leaves poor communities behind.
Dirty industries are frequently cited in low-income communities and communities of color because their residents are seen as having little power to stop them. Oxnard didn't see it that way.
Its citizens may be economically poor, but the community has a rich tradition to draw on.
This community is a farmworker community, and they have learned to stand up for their rights, to unionize, to have jobs that are safe, to have protection from pesticides, succeeding many times, but not always, but they don't give up.
The Oxnard City Council voted unanimously against the Puente project. Residents organized under the banner of the Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy.
And everything came together. The environmental community, the social justice community, scientific experts who talked about sea level rise, the energy portfolio, the impact on our disadvantaged community health-wise.
Hundreds attended hearings and rallies. The usual gray heads from the environmental movement were there, but much of the energy and turnout came from young Latinos.
I'm telling you, when high school students go to the Public Utilities Commission or the Energy Commission, they get attention. We're leaving them with a legacy of toxics, climate change, of limited opportunities. So they're telling us, now you have to do the right thing. It's very compelling.
But it wasn't enough. Even in the face of united local opposition, the California Public Utilities Commission still voted to approve the new power plant.
But that's not the end of the story.
The project had one more hoop to jump through. It needed a license from the California Energy Commission. In an unprecedented move, the energy commissioners announced that they would deny the permit, sending the utility back to the drawing board to come up with a cleaner alternative.
To understand how this victory was snatched from the jaws of defeat, you need to know a little bit about how our electric grid works. We asked Todd Olinsky-Paul, project director for the Clean Energy States Alliance, to explain.
Our electrical grid is the largest just-in-time system in the world. It's a system where you have demand constantly fluctuating up and down, and you have to continually vary generation to meet that fluctuating demand in real time. So when you walk into the room and turn the light switch on, somewhere, some generation facility is increasing its output by just that little increment to make sure that you've got enough power. Right around the time that the solar production is falling off because the sun is going down is about the same time that people are coming home and turning all their appliances on, and then you get a mismatch between solar generation and peak demand. What you have to do then is turn on gas peaker plants in order to very rapidly replace the solar generation that you're losing. And so one of the results of this is that we have to oversize our grids. Our entire system has to be sized to meet peak demand. And as a result, because those peaks only come infrequently, these generating plants are being paid to sit there and wait for demand spikes. Much of the time, a huge fraction of our generation capacity sits idle.
Along with not having enough energy in the evening, we also have the opposite problem. This is Peter Allstone, scientist at the Schatz Energy Lab and associate professor of environmental engineering at California's Humboldt State University.
Our state is definitely overbuilt in terms of the generating fleet that we've got. In the early 2000s, before we started adding lots of solar and wind to the grid, there were enough fossil fuel and nuclear and hydro power plants to carry our loads, so we were good. In the subsequent years, we've added significant fractions of solar and wind power, and those fossil fuel power plants don't just evaporate. They're still there. A lot of times in the middle of the day, on a sunny day, we have to turn off solar panels or turn down wind turbines because we just have too much renewable energy to use at that moment. And that's essentially what we call curtailed or spilled renewables. Even when we're spilling renewables, we're still burning natural gas to generate electricity because some natural gas power plants have to be online producing power so that they're hot and ready for carrying that evening peak.
Curtailment is becoming more and more common.
It used to be a very rare event. In 2015, 2016, it started to become a common event. Curtailment is going to be a daily event, particularly in the spring and the fall this coming year.
Sometimes California actually has to pay other states to take our excess electricity.
If you try to put more electricity in than people are taking out, the whole thing goes kablooey. Those times when we have excess solar and wind, we have to essentially push electricity into Nevada or into Washington. In those cases, you sometimes have to pay those states because that's making them deviate from their plans. Negative price electricity means we will pay you to turn the lights on.
The Oxnardians and their allies had a better solution to the problem of energy mismatch: batteries that literally save the day. Batteries have been used for many years to store energy from solar panels in homes that are off the grid. But we're talking about much bigger batteries that store electricity generated by wind and solar farms to power the grid itself.
No matter what size they are, battery storage systems do the same thing.
Battery storage can absorb that excess solar at midday and then discharge it later in the evening when demand is higher and solar production is lower. So one way to think of this is that poles and wires transmit electricity over space. Energy storage technologies transmit electricity over time.
In case that didn't sound enthusiastic enough, Craig Lewis puts it this way.
Energy storage is the nirvana that completes the renewable energy revolution to allow for intermittent renewable energy sources to provide energy 24/7.
Craig is the executive director of the Clean Coalition, a nonprofit group that provides policy and technical expertise to accelerate the switch to clean energy. The Oxnard community recruited Craig's group to prove to regulators that solar plus battery storage is an affordable alternative to a peaker plant.
So we did a study that showed two things. Solar plus storage can meet all of the technical requirements that a Puente plant would provide and do it far more cost-effectively for the ratepayer.
Here's why. Electricity generated by peaker plants is the most expensive energy on the grid. Even though they sit idle most of the day, utilities have to pay to keep peakers online and ready. Also, since the price of grid energy fluctuates according to supply and demand, utilities buying when demand is high pay a higher price. Contrast this with a solar plus battery system that stores cheap energy to use during peak periods and, when supply exceeds demand and prices go negative, can even get paid to charge its batteries. The cost of building a new power plant also depends on where it hooks up.
You mean like her place or my place?
Kinda. It's about where the generation connects to the grid. And it's more like the difference between taking someone home versus going to a motel.
A rule of thumb is if you see steel power poles, those are the transmission grid. Because you're at really high voltages, you got to get those wires way off the ground. And when you get in closer to where people live and work, then you step the voltages down to distribution levels, which is where you see wood power poles.
Centralized power plants hook up to the transmission grid, and the cost is paid by utilities, who pass it on to us, the ratepayers. It's different for energy that's made in the community.
Energy that is generated locally is interconnected within the distribution grid, and it gets consumed locally, never utilizing the transmission grid at all. And the big differential here that leading up to is that if you interconnect to the distribution grid, any grid upgrades are paid for by whoever owns the solar project. The ratepayer gets those upgrades for free.
Keeping energy local keeps the money local too.
The economic benefits are huge to the local communities. About 50% of total investment stays in the community in the form of local wages. That is not the case with central generation or large power plants that, you know, kind of parachute in a bunch of people to build them and operate them.
The Clean Coalition study showed that over 30 years, a solar farm with a utility-sized battery system would cost half as much as the gas peaker. With these numbers in hand, the group's policy wonks working at the state capitol and the community keeping up the pressure from below, state energy commissioners decided to vote against granting Puente a permit. Of course, that economic analysis was done before Trump announced his 30% tariff on imported solar panels. What does that mean for projects like Puente? The tariff has the effect of putting solar panel prices back where they were about 2 years ago. But panels are a relatively small part of the cost of these systems, and the price of another expensive component, batteries, is falling rapidly. Analysts are calling the tariff a speed bump, not a roadblock, that will slow but not stop the deployment of solar energy.
So we've told you the story of Oxnard, and we're about to hear from two towns using solar plus batteries in New England.
But wait, we're halfway into a show about batteries, and we still have no idea how they work. Most of the batteries we're talking about are lithium, so I asked Peter Allstone, our environmental engineering professor at HSU, to explain what's going on inside.
How do lithium batteries work? I barely get it. I had to look it up before I came to talk to you. I get it for like an hour after I read about it every time, and then I forget some of the details.
Oh, that doesn't bode well.
The negative side of the battery is graphite. It's pencil lead. The positive side is lithium cobalt oxide or lithium manganese or lithium iron phosphate.
Peter was right. He's a very good and patient explainer, but the answer is not only hard to remember, it also took more time for me to understand than we have for this whole show. So to make the information go down easier and stay down, we decided to spice it up. We start with lithium and its outer shell electron. I'll be giving you the play-by-play.
Lithia, mi querida, ever since you rescued me by killing that spider, all I can think about is kissing you.
Electron, my dearest, when I went to work as a maid in your mansion, I never dreamed that I would find love.
I'm drawn to you with a powerful attraction.
Without you, I feel incomplete.
Oh, come live with me in my multi-million-dollar manganese mansion.
Okay.
Lithia and her electron are together at the positive pole of the uncharged battery.
And so they lived in comfort and domestic bliss until the jealous head of a pencil cartel kidnapped Lectron. Loyal Lithia followed them to an island in the middle of a river.
Solar energy is charging the battery, moving Lithia and Lectron to the negative pole.
You're my prisoners now. I will leave you on this barren outcropping of graphite and plop the drawbridge behind me so you can never get away.
The disconnected battery holds its charge.
It was not long till Lithia realized that being marooned on graphite was nothing like vacationing in Cozumel.
I miss my Nespresso. Let's go home.
Lithia, my darling, I can no longer hide my secret. I hope you will still love me when I confess. I can't swim.
Oh, no worries, mi amor. I'll stay with you, and sooner or later, that drawbridge will come down, and we'll both escape to freedom.
Finally, the day arrives.
The circuit closes.
Gracias a Dios. The drawbridge is open.
But the bridge is so high, and after all this time away from my personal trainer, I'm too weak.
I'll float across the river with the current, save my energy. Then I'll send it to you by mental telepathy to give you strength to climb.
Oh, farewell, my love. Someday we'll meet again on the other side. Parting is such sweet sorrow.
Don't you think you're overdoing it a bit?
Each traveling their separate path, Lithia and Lectron cross the river.
Lithia through an electrolyte solution and Lectron over the electrical circuit.
Return to the palace and are reunited.
Home at last.
But as they mount the front steps, Lithia slips and hits her head. Gazing into Lectron's eyes, she says,
"Who are you?"
And the whole saga begins again.
That was a bit heavy on the cheese. How long does this show go on?
About 10 seasons, with somewhere between 4,000 and 10,000 episodes, or charge cycles if you want to get technical.
I'm already emotionally exhausted. But before we move on, I still have a few questions. Is there enough lithium on the planet to make all the batteries we need?
According to U.S. Geological Survey estimates, we have about a 100-year global supply. That's enough time for researchers working on batteries with more available ingredients to come up with a workable alternative.
I've heard it takes a lot of energy to make a lithium battery. Could making these batteries cause more greenhouse gas emissions than the peaker plants they replace?
We got Peter to do some back-of-the-envelope calculations, and he found that the lifetime emissions from a grid-scale battery are about equivalent to 1 year of emissions from a gas-fired plant. Since the battery will last 10 years or longer, that makes it at least 10 times cleaner.
Now that we're all up on the theory of battery storage, let's hear from the people who are actually doing it. Sterling is a small central Massachusetts town about 50 miles west of Boston. Until last year, its greatest distinction was being the home of Mary Sawyer, the inspiration for Mary Had a Little Lamb. A few visitors still come to see the statue of Mary and her lamb on the town commons, but the big attraction these days is the municipal utility's solar plus battery microgrid, which is attracting visitors from around the world.
Yesterday, we had our ninth country come visit us. A group from Brazil came up yesterday afternoon to visit the site in a snowstorm, ironically.
That's Sean Hamilton, Sterling Municipal Light's general manager.
And we've had Germany, Denmark, Japan, Malaysia, Taiwan, Sweden.
This small New England town is no hotbed of radicalism. The motivation to install battery storage was purely practical.
A solution to lower our peaks. That was kind of our main objective. We had installed 3 megawatts of solar in town, which is about 30% of our peak. Originally was helping us, but as more and more solar comes online, the peak gets pushed further and further out. Peaking used to be 1-2 in the afternoon, and now with solar, it's pushed out to 4, 5, 6 o'clock at night.
Creating the same mismatch problem we saw in California.
The peaking plant we thought was our only solution until the batteries came along.
Todd Alinsky-Paul's organization, the Clean Energy States Alliance, was instrumental in getting the battery project off the ground. Here's Todd describing the project.
They put down some concrete slab. The battery company came in with a couple of shipping containers that had the batteries, the inverters, and all the other equipment in them, put them down, wired them up, and they were off and running.
Savings have been even better than expected.
We've just completed the 13th month of the project. The savings to the ratepayers have been over $400,000, actually $412,000 to be exact.
The project is on track to pay itself off within 3 years. Without any outside funding, it would still break even in less than 7. With profitability established and the technical kinks worked out, the town has gone on to partner with a private developer on another solar plus battery project. Sean credits the collaboration of state and federal energy agencies for the smooth launch of their first battery project. That joint effort paid off not just for Sterling. The technical groundwork and lessons learned are the foundation for new storage projects across the country and around the world.
Green Mountain Power, Vermont's statewide utility, is another pioneer in battery plus storage. Josh Castanguay, Vice President of Innovation, takes us on a virtual tour of one of their projects in Rutland, Vermont.
So basically, if you imagine like an 11-acre landfill that was capped in the late 80s, and it's just been sitting there as a big grass hill for decades, we built 2.5 megawatts DC of solar, about 7,700 panels. And then off of the solar, you have the cables and things that come down from the solar arrays and go into these containers.
These are big steel shipping containers with stacks of things that look like car batteries. And inside those batteries are stacks of little batteries about the size of a AA, where Lithia and Electron do their thing, making DC electricity. Then you've got inverters to change the DC power to AC and a transformer to step up the voltage. From there, the electricity goes out onto a microgrid, a very local branch of the distribution grid that can disconnect and run independently in the event of a power outage.
It connects to a local high school that's right there that can be an emergency shelter and actually be islanded in the case of a grid outage or an emergency, meaning it can run just off the solar and batteries without being connected to the rest of the grid, which is great from a resiliency standpoint.
Rutland's school/shelter can run on battery alone for several weeks and indefinitely if the sun is shining. Using battery energy to lower peak energy from the grid is also really paying off for the utility.
An example of that is August of 2016, we reduced our peak at the right hour and saved our customers $200,000 in 1 hour.
This strategy has been so successful that Green Mountain plans to continue building solar plus battery installations.
Our goal is to get somewhere around 100, 150 megawatts of controllable energy storage deployed over the next 3 to 5 years to really take down our peak as aggressively as we can.
Green Mountain is taking the idea of distributed energy even further, farming out battery storage to customer homes. The utility purchased several thousand Tesla 2.0 power walls, batteries designed for residential use, which they rent to households which want them.
The customer gets the battery in their home for $15 a month, and in exchange, we can tap into the battery for peak shaving services. And the customer also gets the resiliency aspect. Basically, if the grid goes down, if there's an outage, the battery will run your home. We don't do any like paid advertising or marketing. We really try to do earned media, word of mouth. When we announced the Powerwall 2.0 partnership, we had about 1,000 folks sign up within a few days.
The system was put to the test last fall.
Vermont experienced in October one of the worst. It's probably in the top three worst storms we've had in the history of Vermont. It was a windstorm that came in and just destroyed trees and property all over Vermont. We had over 50,000 customers impacted, and there were millions and millions impacted throughout New England. The first handful of Powerwall 2.0 customers had just been installed, and everything performed flawlessly. In fact, we had some customers that were out for a little over 3 days, and their Powerwall and solar kept their whole house cranking along. They were ecstatic. That was awesome proof positive of the system functioning the way it should and helping customers become much more resilient. The reality is, in a world of a changing climate, we expect severity of storms to continue to get worse. So we have to continually find new solutions.
Keeping energy local improves resiliency in other ways.
The more miles of line that you have to move energy, the more that can go wrong in between. So what we're focused on is essentially shrinking that distance, moving to something that's much more home, business, community-based, and it won't happen overnight, but removing ourselves from dependency on the bigger grid.
Storing solar energy in batteries is no longer the stuff of science fiction. It's happening now, and with costs rapidly falling, we'll see many more batteries saving the day in the years to come.
Utility managers like Josh and Sean say that batteries are an essential part of transforming our energy system.
It's not like it's a cool technology that we want to try out. We look at it now as a must-do. It is an integral part of the grid of the future. It's going to be looked at, I think, in the same way as a transmission line or some other piece of critical infrastructure today.
Some utilities are stepping forward, but to build a clean and just future for everyone, as fast as we must for our planet, Oxnard City Councilwoman Carmen Ramirez says people must take the lead.
I am a firm believer that change can come from the bottom, like it has in Oxnard. It won't necessarily be the governor or the legislature. It will be from the people. And I think that's what the example of Oxnard's about. This probably was the last gas-fired power plant proposal in California, and it's over. And Oxnard did it.
I'm Brian Curtis.
And I'm Wendy Ring.
And you've been listening to Cool Solutions, a show about people and communities protecting our climate from the bottom up.
Thanks to our guests, Carmen Ramirez, Peter Allstone, Todd Olinsky-Paul, Craig Lewis, Sean Hamilton, Josh Castanguay, and our radio novelistas, Ivan Gamboa, Veronica Brooks, and Matthew Atkins. Music today by Scott Holmes, Piano Chocolate, Los Sundayers, Alexander Ossipoff, and Josh Woodward. You can hear Cool Solutions on the first Wednesday of each month at 1:30 in the afternoon, or you can listen to our shows anytime online at khsu.org/coolsolutions.